Jason Dias, do solemnly swear that I will support and defend the Constitution of the United States against all enemies, foreign and domestic, that I will bear true faith and allegiance to the same, and that I will obey the orders of the President of the United States and the orders of the officers appointed over me, according to the regulations and the Uniform Code of Military Justice. So help me God. March 4th, San Antonio, Texas, 1986.
That is absolutely right. Welcome to the Power Performance. My name is Jason Dias, and a long flight in an 01 Bird Dog. We're going to talk about that in a second, up to Charleston, South Carolina, but a short flight on the Millennium Falcon. His name is Tough Talking Dr. Troy Sir. Hey, Dr. Troy, how are you?
I am doing fine this morning and very excited about the fact that we're going to be celebrating military service and just doing a very special Veterans Day performance. And special shout out to you, my friend, for your service as well.
Absolutely. It's hard to believe that it's going to be 30 years ago next March that I took that oath there at the MEP station in San Antonio, Texas. It's going to be a great, great show. The show is called The Power Performance, the show that asks the question, if your brand were a band, would you leave the audience wanting more? But on Veterans Day, we step aside and very rightly so celebrate a great and tremendous veteran from somewhere in the credit union marketplace. And man, we hit the jackpot today. It might be Friday the 13th, Troy, but this is everybody's lucky day because we're going to be speaking to Vietnam veteran and CEO of Peach State Federal Credit Union, Marshall Boutwell. He's going to talk to us about flying low and slow over the deadly dangerous battlefield of Vietnam. We're going to ask him about his military career and how he applies that to his leadership, which I know you love talking about at Peach State Federal Credit Union. And as I like to remind people, this is not a PowerPoint presentation. This is a true story about courage, dedication, and leadership. And we are looking forward to talking to Marshall. And we're going to do it all right after this.
Well, the midnight headlight, find you on a rainy night, steep grade up ahead. Slow me down, make you no time. But I got to keep rolling. Those are windshield wipers, slapping out a tempo, keeping perfect rhythm with the song on the radio. But I gotta keep rolling. Ooh, I'm driving my life away, looking for a better way for me.
His name is Marshall Boutwell. Marshall, welcome to the show.
Well, good morning. Pleasure
and
to be
thank
here.
Thank you for your service. Yep.
Thank you very much. I could probably do with less sound effects, but it was my pleasure to serve, and I'm glad I did, and we don't look back.
No, we don't. Hey, listen, we're so excited to have you on. Let's get started with where you are right now. Tell us a bit about you and your career with Peach State Federal Credit Union.
Well, I started with credit unions over 30 years ago as a volunteer and later as a vendor providing services, but for the last 21 years, I've been the CEO here at Peach State, formerly known as Gwinnett Federal Credit Union. We were a teacher's credit union, basically, when we got started, and when I joined the credit union in 1994, we were $14 million in assets, had two branches and about 4,000 members. Currently, we're about $300 million with 13 locations serving eight counties in Georgia, and we remain education-centric, but we've broadened our field of membership considerably to include communities and low-income groups and other employer SEGs. So now we serve about 45,000 members, and we've grown from 14 employees to about 125. So we've had some success, and we're very focused on the social mission of credit unions.
And you know, it's really great when you talk about that because, you know, as you can see, you've grown in this mission of people helping people. And when we talk about the military and we talk about veterans, that service is truly people helping people. What a great connection that we're able to make that today. And, you know, I wanted to ask about your entry into the military. And one of the backdrops for me that I will just mention is that I thought that the Vietnam War was a very different way in which people got involved in the military. Whereas today, it seems that there's a much more broader perspective of, yes, it's good, let's go ahead and sign up, let's get going, let's maybe choose that as a career. But in the Vietnam scenario, weren't individuals just drafted? Like, they really didn't have the choice of whether they wanted to go or not?
Well,
how did that
play
into you, into what your choices were?
Sure. There was a draft, and a lot of people were draftees. I grew up in a military family. My father was a career officer in the Marine Corps and an aviator. So I've always been kind of military-oriented, and I volunteered. I was in college wasting my father's money. I had a great time for that year at UNC, but my story is that I had two groups of friends, and they partied on different nights. So I decided to go into the military, and I chose the Army because my father was in the Marine Corps, and that was a very small service, and I did not want either help or hindrance because of the fact that somebody knew my old man. So I volunteered and went into the Army. I knew I was going to OCS. And when I signed up, they asked, what branch of the Army do you want? And they had three choices, and I put infantry. So it was in the midst of the Vietnam War, and I fancy myself a bit of a patriot, and I was going to go fight for my country. I went through training, went to basic and AIT at Fort Ord, California, and then returned east to go to Benning School for Boys. That's the infantry OCS at Fort Benning, Georgia. And prior to starting the class, we had a five-week holdover, and a group of us went to the CO and said we wanted to go to airborne training. And so the commanding general thought that was pretty cool, and about 80 or 100 of my classmates and I went to parachute training there at Fort Benning and became airborne qualified before going through OCS. Of course, that gave us a great leg up, a great advantage physically. Our training, we were well-trained physically, and when the TAC officers wanted to take us out and punish us by running, they had to follow behind the formation with a car because we could outrun them all.
Well, you and I have something in common. I didn't go to basic training at Fort Ord, but I was stationed at Fort Ord from 1986 to 1989 in one of the most beautiful places you will ever find on this earth, the Monterey Peninsula out in California. Like you, I can see it from where I'm broadcasting over on my credenza. I've got my certificate over there from the U.S. Army Ranger and the U.S. Army Airborne Infantry School from Fort Benning, Georgia, and that famous infantry motto, follow me. You've talked to us a bit about your early time in the military. I want to jump into what you did when you get over to Vietnam, because a lot of people, when they think about Army aviation in Vietnam, very naturally think of the ubiquitous Huey helicopter. But there was also a fixed wing component of the Army at the time. And I want people to kind of imagine a very small pickup truck with a wing on top, unarmed, top end about 130 miles per hour, which probably sounds kind of fast.
No. About 110 miles an hour
about
at
110.
Top speed. You could get 130 in a dive, but
right. But tell us about the Cat Killers. Don't call PETA people. This was just the name of the group. The name was. Tell us about. Put us in the cockpit of that bird dog. Tell us a bit about the airplane and the mission.
Well, briefly before that, let me tell you how I got to be a pilot. I was in Ranger school, and I called my girlfriend and asked her to marry me over the phone. She's now my wife of over 47 years. Because she said yes, I needed to delay my trip to Vietnam a little bit, so I volunteered for flight school. Department of Aviation called me up and asked me, what do you want, fixed wing or rotary? And I selected the class based on the start date of the class, and that's the reason I went fixed wing. Then I went through training at Fort Stewart and then Fort Rucker, Alabama, where I was trained in the bird dog. Immediately after that, 30 days leave, and then off to Vietnam. There I volunteered for the 220th Recon Airplane Company, better known as the Cat Killers, based up in Phu Bai, just south of Hue in I Corps. And the reason I volunteered for that was because they supported the Marine Corps that happened to be in the northern, or I Corps, the northern sector of South Vietnam. Checked in up there and got assigned to the 1st Platoon that also supported the Marine Corps, and spent 8 months with the Cat Killers, and then later 4 months with the 184th nonstop down in 3 Corps, where I had the opportunity to fly in Cambodia. But I flew up along the DMZ and from Da Nang to the DMZ, the Ashaw Valley, flew out over Khe Sanh and all those kind of things. It wasn't as hot. The war wasn't as hot when I checked in with the Cat Killers. But we flew around 900 to 1,000 feet above the ground. We'd go on reconnaissance missions. We would go on convoy duty. We would go out and work with troops that were moving on the ground to be available for air support. We would often have an observation or artillery observer in the back seat who would call naval gunfire or land artillery to support the troops if they had an engagement. And from time to time, the Cat Killers got to run airstrikes, and we were the only bird dog unit in Vietnam that regularly ran airstrikes in support of the Marine Corps on the ground.
Well, you know, that sounds, I mean, gosh, I can't even imagine for myself, you know, all of that activity and coming together in those, in that particular situation. I want to comment on one thing is that, do you feel sometimes as though, like, when you were in the military and some of your activities, that you were, like, you were in a crisis, and so therefore a lot of your actions were all precipitated on, I've got to think quickly and I've got to act prudently and move forward without having a whole lot of time to sit around and then talk about it.
Well, that's very true, Dr. Hall. Some people have kind of defined painted combat as lots and lots of hours of boredom and then moments of panic and everything else. But you do a lot of training, but when as soon as the first shot is fired, all the plans go out the window and you have to react to whatever the situation is.
Now, I
will tell you, I was not in a lot of those kinds of situations. I have several that I was involved in, but that's where the boredom comes in. But most of that boredom time, you're out doing reconnaissance and trying to figure out where the enemy is so that you can assist the ground forces in finding and fixing the enemy and destroying the enemy. So but that's the nature of warfare.
Yeah, and what are a couple lessons that you can take from them, that you took from the military and you brought back into your civilian work? You know, what are some things maybe that you lead your team with today that you kind of say, you know, I can really connect that back to that early experience?
Well, I'm not sure that I can connect it to a particular crisis, but I can say this, that one of the things that you get in the Army and especially in your leadership training through OCS and Ranger School, things like that. Number one, we can all do a whole lot more than we ever thought we could. And it gives you the intestinal fortitude to do things. Go ahead and make a decision and do them. And I think from a leadership perspective, one of the weaknesses that I see is hesitation, fear of making a mistake. Most of us do good things day after day after day, and we build up a bank, a forgiveness bank with our boards. And if you do good most of the time and you occasionally make a mistake, that forgiveness bank is there. Now you have to, the risk management comes into play, but a lot of that does come from the military. You have to be accountable. You are responsible. I thought I was going to be responsible for 30 men on the ground as an infantry platoon leader, or 120 men as an infantry company commander. Because my wife said yes, I became a pilot, and I was more responsible for myself, the guy in the back seat, but I was responsible for those guys on the ground to try to help them whenever they needed help. And we did have some occurrences where we did just that, and I'm very proud of it.
Well, let me ask you, because I know you mentioned, and it's certainly true, that when you're in country, what we used to call being downrange, it is hours and hours of boredom punctuated by just moments of sheer terror and panic. Yep. But at least in one of those situations, you were in a situation where you were injured. You do have a Purple Heart and a Distinguished Flying Cross. Can you tell us a bit about that?
Well, that was doing something I shouldn't have been doing. So, which is not unusual for bird dog pilots in Vietnam. That was with the 184th down in Cambodia, and we had a situation where the American forces were sweeping through an area, going from tree line to tree line across rice paddies and things like that, and we saw some people moving away from the troops. And I went down to check them out and see if they were friendlies or not. And I guess I was probably 100 feet off the ground. I didn't see. They were in black pajamas, and I didn't see any weapons. And so I was just cruising down to check them out. And one of them pulls out an AK-47 on full automatic and does a John Wayne number on me. And I just quickly broke to the right and pulled out and did all kinds of evasive maneuvers. And a bullet went through the aircraft right next to my arm, exploded some shrapnel into the arm, and later found out the exit was just above my head. So if I had not been leaning back in my seat, I might not be talking to you today. But, we weren't supposed to go below 1,000 feet. I rarely flew above 1,000 feet, but going down to 100 feet, I definitely shouldn't have been doing. And that incident was written up by the artillery observer's CO, and I didn't even know about it. I received the DFC when I got back to the States, and I was a little embarrassed by it because they said I lost control of my aircraft, and I sure as heck did not. those things happen, actually, There was one episode or one incident up in I Corps where I probably deserved something for it, and I never did because it never got turned in. I never reported it or anything. But I was headed back to Phu Bai and was getting ready to land in Dong Ha to refuel, and there was an emergency call that went out, came out from a Marine recon unit, probably a 6-man unit, but I'm not sure, 5 to 7. Individuals had gotten themselves surrounded by a platoon-sized element of North Vietnamese regulars, and they were in the, we won't use the word, but they were in the mess. And so I quickly got some fuel put in the tank and got on station within about 5 minutes. It was dark. There was enough moonlight that I could get a horizon and see basic, I could tell the difference between trees and sand on the ground, but I located them through their they had a beacon, laser, type light, strobe light, and that was with a cone on it, so they couldn't be seen from the side. And I located them, and the only ordnance I had on board were four Willie Pete rockets, white phosphorus rockets. But if white phosphorus gets on your skin, it'll burn. So I did a series of rocket runs. I'd go hot and I'd go cold, just to delay. They had an extract team on the way from Quang Tri, which is about 20 miles away. And so I spent about 5 minutes going through these rocket runs. And on the second or third hot run, the recon leader came back and said, cat killer, you've got one. I can hear him screaming.
Wow.
So I know that there were at least one casualty from that. And I finished the run, and about that time, the extract team arrived with three or four helicopters, and I said, I'm out of ordnance, and I'm not needed, and I'll see you guys later. Good luck to you. And I flew home to Fubai and checked the plane in and went to the bar and had a celebratory drink, you know. But I know that in that case, I rendered aid to a half a dozen Marines on the ground and may have helped them. Oh, I know I helped them, may have saved somebody, don't know. But that was very gratifying, and I think about that all the time. You have to improvise, figure out a way to help the people on the ground, and that's what we did by just doing those hot and cold rocket runs and using what resources we had available.
Now, Jason and Marshall, I don't want to diminish your responsibility and the activity you have there, but I just will capture for just a moment that one of the lessons I have now learned is that after your day is done, there's nothing wrong with going to the bar and having a drink. Okay, so I just wanted to say that, just for what it was worth, you know, like, you know, maybe, you know, I can take that away, and I'm sure in some of this millennial group that I'll do some leadership with, they'll appreciate that lesson, like, hey, it's okay, you know?
Okay, right.
It is okay, you know, you don't have to go
do
drop bombs
first,
and fly
you've
planes
do your work
to have
first,
a drink
though.
After
yeah.
work, you know? So.
Someone told the crashers at the GAC, though, you have to do your work first, then you go.
You got to do your work first, then
yeah,
you get to have a... That's right. That's what it is. So, oh, my gosh.
Well,
well, listen, let me ask you, Marshall. We talk a lot. Troy is has a PhD in global leadership. And I'll be honest, a lot of the stuff that I see sometimes in social media and online about leadership is all about, you know, taking care of the emotional needs of the people you're leading. And I'm sure that's part of it. But I love listening to you talk about, you know, improvising and taking charge and the situation dictates. Since we were just talking about the crashers, the young leaders in the credit union marketplace, if you had a chance to speak to all of them in a big auditorium and their question to you was, hey, what is your advice as a credit union chief executive and a military veteran, what advice do you have for young aspiring leaders in the credit union marketplace?
Do something. You have to take risk.
Yep.
Leadership, there's so many definitions of leadership and traits of good leaders. I think you have to have a vision for what the future can be, what you want for your organization. And you sit down with your boards and you draw that picture and everybody is on the same sheet of music and you know what that long-term goal is. And then leadership is assembling a group of people into a team to figure out how we're going to get from here to that long-term vision. And understand that nothing is locked or written in stone. There's going to be changes that have to be made because every plan, as MacArthur said, once the first bullet's fired, every plan goes out the window and you have to react to what's happening on the ground. But making decisions. Now, I do believe, and the Army teaches this, company commanders and platoon leaders, they have to become or be, try to be, all things to their people. You know, they're their mama and daddy, they're their judge and jury and executioner in some cases with non-judicial punishment and things of that nature. But it's all about your people. making sure that your people have the resources and the environment to do their job. I operate with a default position that when somebody tells me something, they're telling me the truth. Right. I operate with a default position that everybody wants to do a good job. When an organization fails, it's the lack of good leadership. When an organization succeeds, it's the result of a lot of people with a lot of good leaders, because there's leaders throughout your organization. Every little small team has a leader. And so, I don't know, that's kind of my philosophy of it.
And I really appreciate that too, Marshall. I mean, it speaks volumes to exactly, you know, to even just the practices that we are still learning today in regards to leadership and the responsibility that people have. And sometimes I think that as individuals are looking for opportunity, they miss the ones that are right in front of them, because there are many times that individuals are called to leadership from an implicit standpoint as opposed to being explicitly defined a leader. And so that means they have to seize those opportunities when they become available and take those opportunities to do leadership. And what you speak about in your defaults are really good tenets for leaders to remember, that we should be operating from a purity of heart, not only from our own purity of heart, but I think there is a general acceptance that and I mean, there are some crazy people in this world, so I don't want to, you know, all of a sudden go off on the anomaly. But I just want to say that for the most part, people don't wake up in the morning going, how can I mess you over today? But now, you know, there's a group that does, but generally in the workforce, it doesn't happen like that.
And Dr. Hall, let me say this, too. We happen to be working in an industry or a movement that affords us an even better opportunity. Because all we have to do is take care of our members and take care of our employees. We don't have to worry about the investors, because the investors are the members.
Correct.
And so being mission-oriented as a leader, get that mission, have that vision, and then work diligently for it and have good core values. Do the right thing. It's not hard. Now, you have to know what the right thing is, but most of us do. That's kind of part of our innate character.
You're exactly right, because here's the deal. There is not one person that can tell you they didn't know they were lying.
That's true.
I mean, when you think about it, you know whether you're lying or not. So the reality becomes is that we know the difference between right and wrong, good and bad.
That's right.
It's whether
right.
we choose to embrace it or whether we try to pretend to work around it. That's
right.
The difference.
Jason, I was told one time by one of my mentors that I hire based on character. And what differentiates me from others is my passion for what I do. And I think that upon reflection and looking around and the people that I have surrounded myself with and given opportunities, I realized that individual was right. And I do have a passion for what we do. And it translates into a lot of good things for a lot of people. I love what I do. I love who I do it for, and I love who I do it with. I was asked, or have been asked from time to time, Marshall, when are you going to quit working and retire? Now, I'm 68 years old, and I've been at it for 21 years here, but I kind of tell people with tongue-in-cheek a little bit that I quit working 21 years ago. What better place to work or be part of than the credit union system, the credit union movement, where we are challenged to serve people of modest means? And if you think about it, when you look at this nation demographically, the top 5% can go anywhere and get anything they want at the price they're willing to pay. And the bottom 10 or 15 or 20% are unemployed or underemployed, and that is not our social mission to fix. So that middle 75 to 80% is our target market. That's the working class people of this country. And I'd love to have top 5 and top 10 percenters as members of the credit union, but I don't chase them.
Right.
So,
yeah, excellent. I really appreciate having you with us
too.
Today, and I know, Jason, you're going to wrap it up here for us because we're out of time. We got to run.
Well,
but,
no, I did make
Marshall, thank
I did,
you so much.
Yeah, sure. And I did make the show a little bit longer today just in case people – and we do have a lot of people listening live. I'm looking at the board, and quite a few people in Georgia and some folks in Ohio are tuning in. People don't – we don't advertise that you can listen on hold, but people figure it out. Hey, listen, and Troy, I know if you've got to go, you've got to go. But Marshall
– yeah, I'm running for the day. I got to go to my next event. Marshall, it was awesome listening to
pleasure
you.
Pleasure talking
great
to you.
Great lessons. Yes, absolutely. Yep. Jason, you have a great day,
yes,
man.
Sir. Yes, sir, you too. Hey, listen, when you're not at the credit union, though, what are some things that you enjoy doing? What kind of hobbies and things do you enjoy?
Well, I used to play golf, but my knees are not cooperating, and I'm a little bit competitive, and when I couldn't hit a break 90, I decided it's enough for me. So I'm getting into reading, spend time with my wife in the North Georgia mountains, and time with my grandkids up in Connecticut, and that's about it. I'm active in the community, and so I got plenty to do.
On behalf of Dr. Troy and myself and everybody here at the Power Performance, first, I know you want to. I want to let you give it a chance. You got anybody you want to do a shout out to with the old Cat Killers? I know you sent the link out to some folks.
Oh no, just to all the Cat Killers and the Nonstops. We recently had an all bird dog reunion to dedicate a memorial to our fallen comrades in Vietnam, and it was a great gathering of old soldiers, and it was closure for some people.
Yeah.
It was very good, and we had a wonderful time reminiscing and realizing what a 45 years and 20 to 50 pounds and gray hair or no hair, it really can change your appearance, but we're all young at heart.
Absolutely. Hey, listen, folks, check out the episode page. There's some great pictures of Marshall right now and then when he was back in the service. When I came home to Kelly Air Force Base from the first Gulf War, we had a lot of people on the airplane. It was a commercial 747 that brought us home. And when we landed, of course, we were all dying to get off the plane because our family was there waiting on us. And it was at nighttime on a Sunday. And the pilot came on. And he made a special announcement, and he said, because this was 1991, we had lots of people on that plane that had served in Vietnam and had now served again in Operation Desert Shield and Desert Storm. And the pilot came on and said, we're going to do something a little different. We're not going to deplane by rank or by row. We want our Vietnam veterans to get off the plane first. And I got to tell you, many a hardcore soldier was crying his eyes out as those Vietnam veterans came down the aisle, and we laughed and we cried by turns. It is, to this, except for the night my son was born, the greatest night of my life. I want to thank all veterans for your service. We celebrate Veterans Day every year on the program because the choices that we make out there in the credit union marketplace and the happiness that we pursue as Americans, we wouldn't be doing that if it weren't for people like Marshall and the folks that he served with and all the soldiers past and present. Marshall, you've been an absolute gentleman. It was an honor to get to know you a little bit this week. I hope we get to chat again in the future. But again, thank you for your service. Thank you for everything you're doing for the credit union marketplace. And you are always, always, always welcome back on our show. Thank you so very, very much.
Thank you, Jason. Appreciate it. You have a great day. And thank you for your service as well. Every day should be Veterans Day, and I think we should all be very proud of what a great nation we have.
Amen to that. Marshall Boutwell, everybody. Great guy. What a Hey, folks, sorry we ran a little long there, but it was certainly worth it. I really encourage you to get out there, check out catkillers.com. I'm going to add that to the episode page. You can find some great stories about Marshall and his guys out there in Vietnam. I want you to understand, when he's talking about making rocket runs, this is not like the jets you see in Top Gun and in the movies, even in World War II, flying fast. This is a unarmored Cessna with rockets attached to the wings. Very, very dangerous. He's a humble guy. You can tell a lot of tremendous humility, but I encourage you to get out there and look up some history about the Cat Killers and the fixed wing aviation that the Army had back in the days of Vietnam. Great, great story. Great, great history. Just a great gentleman to listen to as he represents his credit union down in Georgia, Peach State Federal Credit Union. Hey, everybody else, next week we are scheduled to have Anthony Demagon from NAPQ on the show, talking about his blog, talking about NAPQ, talking about the year that was and the year ahead. This has been the Power Performance, the show that asked the question, if your brand, whether it's Peach State Federal Credit Union or South Carolina Federal Credit Union, if it were a band, would you make the kind of music that your members love listening to? Would you leave that audience wanting more of your products and services? We were honored to step aside today from our normal show format and talk to a tremendous American. Like I said, check out the episode page, some great pictures, and then go check out catkillers.com. We'll get that added to the episode page here as soon as I find the button to say, until next we speak, we will talk to you all next week. Take care. Bye.
The end, that's all, folks.